I start seeing the change in work of astronomers. And we tend to think of astronomers as somebody who is really, really remote. They sit in the ivory tower, both in terms of their professionalization and in the physical tower of observatories somewhere far away. And they're very little, like, they're really, like, they're... How many professional astronomers were in Tokugawa Japan? 10, 15, 20? So it's not a really significant number in the general population. So why would we care about them? We care about them because they determined the way that everybody measured time, because they calculated this, they calculated the calendar. But also because they were the most vivid, they were the one who produced the time and consumed the time. They needed clocks, they needed time measurement. Prior to the 18th century, they had their own special astronomical time system that is very, very different from the one that I described before, but used by everyday, by people in everyday life. And that astronomical time was decimal. Day was divided into 10 units, and then each unit was further divided, and then further divided even more. And this decimal system used to support algebraic calculations that oftentimes they would observe certain phenomena like equinoxes, eclipses, and then add this observational data, calculate big cycles for thousands of years, and then divide back to know the structure of how things going to look for each year in particular. In 18th century, something happens, and they gradually move to employ trigonometry and not algebra. And in trigonometry, they started to measure time, but time here it was a proxy for celestial movement, and it was a proxy for angles and arcs in diagrams. So this picture, for example, it's titled hours in different provinces and towns in Japan. Hours in different seasons. You would not know this from just looking by this, because this diagram represents of how would you calculate the length, the beginning of hours in different seasons in different places in Japan. When you start using trigonometry, astronomers started observing the movement of stars. So if you imagine the diagram, and then the diagram, the center is the Earth, and the part that has an arc is the arc that a certain planet or star making in the skies. And then you connect the dots and create a diagram that later you extrapolate from it for calculations. And this movement, the motion of a planet, of a star, is measured in time. So time, again, is a proxy for celestial movement. Once we translated this into a diagram, which is a small diagram, then the measurement of celestial movement becomes crucial. We don't want to make a mistake, because if we make a mistake in a little bit of time, it translates into a huge, vast, thousands of miles on land. And in order to find a more precise way to measure time, astronomers created a pendulum clock, which was completely different from any clock that was created for everyday use. And this clock was counting about 60,000 swings a day, which is very, very close to just the seconds, the number of seconds that we have a day. And it was specifically made for astronomers' use. When astronomers started using this clock, they also started imagining the universe as a set of pendulums. They had the pendulum in the clock. They started making experiments of trying to understand how pendulum works. And they started thinking of planets, of the whole solar system, as a set of pendulums that they were hanging from the center from the sun. And then something additional happened, and that is astronomers received a trope of, really, really treasure trove of information from England. Sailors, navigators, everywhere, starting from about 16th century, carried with them detailed tables of information, of observational information, to different places on Earth, so that they can calculate where they are in the open sea. It was a practice that people produced themselves, but in the end of 18th century, British government started publishing this they call the nautical almanacs, and selling them to sailors. And that's how one of them got to Japan. When Japanese astronomers got their hands on this, they saw that they had information that they couldn't have possibly get from anywhere else, because there were information from observation from South America, from Africa. Obviously, they couldn't sail to South America or Africa. So that was really, really important. And when they started playing with this data, they started making calculations. Because it was nautical almanac, they started thinking of what would it be like to sail across them in the world, and how would we calculate where we are, if we are in open sea, by using the data that we have. And it was a kind of like a intellectual exercise, because as most of you know, no Japanese could possibly sail abroad at the time. I mean, they could, but they wouldn't be able to return. And here, even in this diagram, there is no continent. So it's kind of like a thought experiment. But people start thinking about what would it be like, hypothetically, to sail abroad, long before Japanese people could actually sail. When I started thinking about this, one of the things came up is that you cannot use the pendulum clock to measure time. Pendulum would stop. Instead, you may use a marine chronometer, which was another recent invention, very, very recent, but marine chronometers were really, really expensive. And most of the sailors, including those who arrived to Japan, could not possibly afford buying one. And they just used Western clocks. They called them chronometers, it was the same name, but they used those in order to find out where they are in the middle of the ocean. And these were the clocks that the watches, Western watches, that then Japanese astronomers decided that they will be using in their calculation as well. They had the data that was Western. They had the watches. It was convenient for them to start using this system. For a while, there was about a year period where they used several systems at the same time. They had a system of decimal system of time measurement. They had a system of pendulum swings. And they had the system of these of Western time. And it's really interesting to see their letters, because they constantly need to say which system are they using. They say, well, it's 12 minutes in the system in which there is 1,440 minutes a day. Or it is 10 minutes in a system in which there are 1,000 minutes a day. Obviously, that was kind of complicated. And at a certain point, they just decided that let's just go with this. This is a good system. But it wasn't just convenience. There was an additional reason. And that is that dealing with navigation, dealing with data from navigation, they remembered a phenomenon that was known everywhere in ancient world, was known to ancient Chinese, it was known to ancient Greek, but was forgotten because it wasn't really important. And this phenomenon is that the actual length of the day from one noon to another is not the same throughout the year. It changes. Now, when you are in the same place all the time, it doesn't really matter. However, if you move away and you're in the middle of the ocean, and the only thing that you can see is the local noon, but you need to compare it to something that was measured somewhere else during different time of the year, then it becomes crucial. This is what we call the equation of time, and that is when we take all the lengths of all the days throughout the year, and we add them together and then divide by the number of days, then we get the length of what we now call 24 hours. So for Japanese astronomers, suddenly there was this realization that the Western watches were not just yet another system that could be used, that was convenient to use. For them, suddenly it represented a different kind of time that was qualitatively different, because it represented the celestial motion. And we have evidence of people actually saying this. One of the most important astronomers in the 19th century, he talks and he says, the Western watch is the watch that measures mean time, which is the astronomical time. That's the time of the universe. The time, the hours that we Japanese use, that they're announced by bells, this is the common time. And it is something that we use that is a convention. But the mean time is the time of the universe. Now, this was going on among astronomers, and you're probably asking, why would anybody care about what astronomers think? Okay, again, like we're talking about 20, 30 people maybe. There are several reasons of why would people care. And why would astronomers themselves, they have change? One is that even though that they calculate calendars, they are related to several other professions that are much more outward looking. One of them is geography. In geography, in order to have a land survey, you need to rely on some of the same techniques that astronomers use in celestial observation in order to have a precise understanding of land measurements. And these are the maps that they were created by Ino Tadataka, who was a famous geographer, who was a student of our astronomers, of the one who read the English Almanac. And as you can see, he created this in 1823, when they were finally published, three sets of maps that they were ginormous and they were extremely precise. And if we go, if you happen to travel to Japan and you go to Sawara, that's the place where Ino Tadataka lived, and there's a museum there, and they put his maps and our current maps one-to-one, and we see that only Hokkaido is a little bit off. And Hokkaido was the place where he could not carry his pendulum clock because the clock was too heavy. After the beginning of Meiji period, when the British came and they say, okay, now we're going to bring enlightenment to you, we're going to survey all the Japanese coast and we're going to give you maps. And they started doing this, and soon they discovered that Ino Tadataka's maps were much more precise than whatever they produced, and they stopped. So that's the level of precision that was conducted, that was made because of the use of astronomical methods as well, and not just land measurement. What is interesting about these maps is that in trying to determine the longitudes and latitudes of Japanese islands, they needed to put a prime meridian. And that was before the world prime meridian was established in Greenwich. That was in much, much later, several decades later. So they needed point zero. And where did they place point zero? They placed it on Kyoto. Kyoto is the cultural capital of Japan, even though that the actual administrative capital moved to Edo. For years and years and centuries, calendars were calculated based on local time in Kyoto. So technically, all the calendars made it so that all Japan was the same time zone long before the idea of time zone was even introduced. And with these maps, now we have that everything, all the counts starts in Kyoto, and all the different places on this map, they're not just places, they're different kind of governmental and different administrative and municipal areas. They are now organically connected to the center, to Kyoto. And they're connected because they relate this connection. It reflects the celestial movement that is measured in time. Another interesting thing that happens is that astronomers and geographers, they need instruments. And clockmakers make a lot of very precise, very important instruments for them to use. But there are not many of them. And clockmakers, they want to make money. They have blueprints of all these instruments. What are they going to do with them? They start producing them and start advertising them to sell to rich people who think that it's funny, that they can just go and make observations or start making land surveys. There are a lot of letters of all these rich people writing to astronomers and say, so I got this wonderful clock. What do I do with this now? And the polite astronomers, I mean, they cannot really refuse because these are really important people. They start to explain to them, this is how you do it. But they couldn't possibly replicate this. But it contributes to the kind of spread of knowledge of a timekeeping of land surveying that people acquire through the use of this instrument. One of them is the person who created this wonderful clock that is on the cover of my book. His name is Tanaka Hisashige. And this clock is a real wonder. It has six faces. Each one manifests different kind of time. One of them is Western time, but there is also different kind of Japanese times. And at the top, there is this kind of planetarium that shows the motion of the sun and the moon above the Japanese archipelago. And the movement of these two, sun and the moon, is calculated according to astronomers' calendar. So it's precise. It's actually representative of what's going on at the time. And the interesting thing about this is that this planetarium and all the clock faces were all set in motion by one single mechanism. So here we have a material manifestation of the idea that you can measure time whatever you want to. You can call it whatever you want to. But underneath all of it, there is some kind of time that is independent of what we do. And this is the time. This is the abstract time that now we think the time is supposed to be. And this clock, the display of this clock, is a material manifestation of how we're supposed to think about time, of our personal use, and underneath all of this, this abstract time that is unchangeable, that is set in motion by the stars. Clockmakers also were the ones who learned about Western timekeeping, and they published all kind of treatises in which they said, they told everybody how to read Western time. This is a very interesting diagram. First of all, you will notice that this is absolutely incorrect. But this was supposed to explain the differences in the beginning of the day, the dawn and dusk. And what they say here, they say, well, in Western timekeeping system, the day, sometimes it begins at 1 hour, at four, sometimes it begins at six, sometimes it begins at eight, and sometimes it doesn't even fall on a round hour at all. It doesn't make any sense. And the person who wrote this treatise, at a certain point, he even says, it's really, really difficult to get into the mind of the Westerners. But I'll do this for you. I'll explain what they mean. Another thing that is really, really important is that the same way that geographers were studying with astronomers, there were a lot of intellectuals, thinkers, activists, economists that started taking classes that they were studying under astronomers. And they started propagating the notion that astronomy, geography, and navigation were the most important things for the government to consider if you wanted your country to prosper. If you wanted it to be politically stable, if you wanted to be economically stable, you needed to base your policy on astronomy, geography, and navigation. So the state of astronomy, it wasn't just yet another profession. It was the model now. And whatever astronomers did, now by 1830s, 40s, and this was actually written even before that, that was something that everybody should try to aspire to behave like them. At the same time, same scholars who said that we need to base our policy on astronomy, geography, and navigation, they looked at their calendars, these wonderful calendars that they talked about, and they say, you know, these calendars, they're full of fables, superstitions, and these are the words that they used. They say that this is nonsense, this is for ignorant people. This is not rational. This is pretty harsh statement. So the old calendar, the old way of counting time, was now associated with something that was backward. And astronomy became the symbol of the progress. And that happened before the beginning of the Meiji period, before this was made into official ideology. On the other hand, Western calendars, in their mind, was a very, very convenient and rational system that was make everything easy. And one of the interesting things is that they were, in a sense, they were even a little bit naive because they expected everything to happen in the same way year after year after year. So it wasn't only that the months, sequence of months, the short month and long month, it was the same. Some of them even expected that it's going to be the same weather on the same day of the year, according to the Western calendar. So they didn't actually know exactly what this calendar is, but it, in their mind, it was a convenient and calendar that could be used for navigation, for geography, for astronomy, and something that we should adopt. And so in 1873, the government and with intellectuals, scholars, which were the minority at the time, they decided to adopt this Western system, which they thought would be more appropriate for governance, which they thought was more rational, that was more convenient to them. They discarded the old calendar. They also discarded the old clocks. And here we see an interesting example of clock that was then remade to measure time according to this new Western system of equal hours. Most of the populations, they were not astronomers, they were not scholars, they didn't know how to measure time in Western units. They were using their clocks that measure time according to a variable system. So they needed something to tell them how to translate one system into another. And these clocks were made into a kind of translation. Now, this is where my book ends, and with this reform. But my research did not end there. And I continue something that is a little bit different. And that is, I noticed that a lot of the clockmakers were also automata makers. Because they knew how to work with gears, they knew mechanism, they had the skills of working with this. They built, this is a very famous one, late 17th century, an automaton that was bringing tea to guests. So a host would set it, wind it up, set it, and this automaton would come and to bring tea to a guest. The guest would take a cup, drink, put it back, and then automaton would circle back and go back to the guest. We know that there are encyclopedia of different kind of automata, and karakuri is the Japanese word for automata. There are a lot of manuals that they connect between clockmaking and automata making, and talk about how to build automata, what's inside automata, and the interesting mechanism. And Tanaka Hisashige that I mentioned before, he also was a very famous automata maker. And a lot of automata that is surviving, that is still working, that we know today, are his. And another one. And this one is very, very interesting because in 20th century, definitely in English, people refer to it as a boy. In Japanese, it's just a child. But there are some writing by Tanaka Hisashige, which he actually talks that it's a girl. It's a girl that is shooting arrows, and that which was kind of erased later because then the whole notion of masculinity and et cetera came up. So somebody who shoots bow and arrow could not be possibly a girl, and that changed, and it changed the perception in 20th century. The interesting thing about Tanaka Hisashige is that with a major period, he opened a shop of electrical different instruments, and it grew and it evolved, and there were several changes of names, and it became an industry. And in 1939, a person who actually studied chemistry, got a PhD in chemistry from Johns Hopkins University, created a merger between different companies that is now known as Toshiba. And in Toshiba, in their museum, there is a direct lineage that they drew from Tanaka Hisashige and his automata to present-day Toshiba and their wonderful technologies. So from my research now, what I'm doing is that I'm trying to understand how we got from this automata to something that we see today, and even the 21st century ones, the clones, the extremely human looking humanoid robots that they make us think not only about what robots can do for us, but also who are we. Thank you.